You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN 91.9 FM. I'm Skylar Butenchen. After facing the threat of an immediate shutdown in May, Tongue Point Job Corps Center in Astoria is now welcoming students back this fall. But as Katie Frankowitz reports, an ongoing lawsuit means there is still uncertainty around the future of the center and the 90-plus other Job Corps centers across the country.
Just a few months ago, Mac McGoldrick, the director of Tongue Point Job Corps Center, was figuring out where around 20 students and more than a dozen staff were going to live if the center closed. Now he's looking at a program that has 165 students and hopes to enroll 200 more, and is also looking to hire additional staff. Tongue Point is a residential training center that serves disadvantaged youth, providing training across a number of fields and industries. In May, the Trump administration abruptly announced it was shutting down the program, a move that impacted 99 Job Corps centers across the country. The National Job Corps Association filed a lawsuit claiming the U.S. Department of Labor's attempt to shut down the centers was illegal. That lawsuit is ongoing. In June, a federal district court granted a request for a nationwide injunction, basically holding the doors open for the centers until the lawsuit is settled one way or another. So while this means Tongue Point can once again welcome in students, house them, train them, graduate them, it does mean the center and its programs remain on uncertain ground. McGoldrick could not comment on the ongoing lawsuit, but otherwise he says they're not shying away from the events of the last 6 months, and they're upfront with staff and students about the current situation. But he says he and the rest of the staff remain committed to making Job Corps work on Oregon's North Coast, operating much as they always have.
I certainly can't guarantee what the future holds, but I, for one, am very, very optimistic that, Job Corps has, like I said, a 61-year proven track record of succeeding for our students. And I really think everybody here is committed to the next 60 years.
When Tongue Point Job Corps faced closure earlier this year, the Astoria City Council led an emergency community meeting. One of the more pressing concerns was how to support the several dozen students and staff who did not have stable housing outside of the Tongue Point campus. At the same time, church groups and others were looking at ways to provide that housing. McGoldrick said he was blown away by the response.
This community really rallied around our staff and our students when the program was, in trouble. To a certain extent, that puts me at least in a certain ease, because I know that should the worst happen again, that this community will respond as it did in June and kind of offer spaces and resources.
Going forward, and knowing the uncertainty, McGoldrick says he is in closer contact with community partners than before. Kevin Leahy is the executive director of the Clatsop Economic Development Resources, or CEDR, and the associate vice president for business, community, and workforce development at Clatsop Community College. He says Tongue Point students fill important roles at local businesses and in a variety of industries that power the North Coast, participating in internships and apprenticeships across Clatsop County.
So we just want to continue to support Tongue Point Job Corps Center because it's such a crown jewel, but also, I guess, to show from a business perspective, the ROI that this center gives back to both Tongue Point as an organization, but also to the community.
For the city of Astoria, Mayor Sean Fitzpatrick told KMUN he plans to stay in communication with McGoldrick and other Tongue Point staff and continue to work with them on what the city can do to support the center. He says it's unfortunate that Job Corps' future is in question, given the need locally and across the country for more people trained in the types and trades taught at Tongue Point. I'm Katie Frankowitz, reporting for KMUN.
The Port of Astoria held a finance committee meeting last week for an audit presentation for the 2025 fiscal year. A representative from the accounting firm Talbot, Corvola & Warwick, LLP, presented the port a clean or unmodified audit, meaning the port's finances were complete, accurate, and reliable. The audit also highlighted the Port of Astoria's reinvestment into infrastructure, including projects like the rehabilitation of the port's Pier 2 and dredging, which allows larger vessels to dock. Port of Astoria Finance Services Manager Melanie Howard says the bottom line is the port is stable. This story comes to us through a news partnership with The Astorian. Read more online at dailyastorian.com. Five people are looking to take on the vacant Ward 4 seat on the Astoria City Council. The public will have a chance to meet them at a town hall meeting today at 5:30 p.m. at Peace First Lutheran Church in Astoria. The candidates include several who have run unsuccessfully for the seat in recent elections, Joshua Conklin and Lisa Morley. Also among the candidates are Mike Brocious, Cindy Bell, and Colin Cummings. At the meeting tonight, the candidates will present themselves and participate in a question and answer session. There will be a chance for attendees to interact one-on-one with the candidates as well. The Astoria City Council will formally interview the applicants on December 1st before voting to appoint someone to the seat. Ward 4 covers roughly the east side of Astoria. City Councilor Vance Lump resigned effective November 1st, saying he had to move out of the district he represented because of the high cost of housing.
You're listening to KMUN. The Oregon Health Authority has found two providers and three insurance plans had unreasonable cost increases in 2023. KLCC's Rebecca Hansen-White reports.
OHA Healthcare Cost Growth Target Program Manager Sarah Bartleman says the state will likely change its approach next year for one of the companies flagged, the Corvallis Clinic. It was acquired by National Healthcare Corporation Optum, which owns another company, Oregon Medical Group, which also had its costs flagged last year.
It became really clear this year as we went through the conversations with the Corvallis Clinic that we really needed to include Optum as the organization that should be held accountable. As the owner of Oregon Medical Group, the Corvallis Clinic, some other practices, that really is how they're being administered now. That's really who's in charge of the contracting. That's who's really running the clinic.
St. Charles Health System in Bend, Pacific Sources Commercial Plan, and United Healthcare and Moda's Medicare Advantage plans were also found to have unreasonably high cost increases. I'm Rebecca Hansen-White reporting.
Oregon is proposing a rule that would require farmers to monitor their fields for nitrate pollution in eastern Oregon's lower Umatilla Basin. But Antonio Sierra reports not everyone is happy with the proposal.
The basin's groundwater has had elevated nitrate levels for more than 30 years. The contamination has long been linked to local agriculture. The proposed rules from the Oregon Department of Agriculture would require large farms to create nitrate management plans and track the chemicals in their soil. The industry has taken issue with some of the testing requirements, while environmental advocates say regulations should be tougher. But ODA Director of Natural Resources Isaac Stapleton says the rules strike the right balance.
We're right down the middle, which I feel like that's probably where we need to be if both sides are criticizing where we're at and have issues. Like, this seems like a good spot for us.
The state will hold two public hearings on the proposed rule before closing public comments on December 22nd. Antonio Sierra reporting.
Washington state health officials are urging the public to get their up-to-date COVID-19 and flu vaccines ahead of the holiday season. This comes as vaccination rates have dramatically decreased. KNKX reporter Mitch Borden has more.
The number of COVID-19 shots being administered have especially dropped compared to this time last year. According to the state's health department, about 23% fewer COVID vaccines have been given out. Flu shots are down by about 10% across the state. Jamilia Shurls is the director of the Office of Immunizations at Washington's Health Department. She says misinformation and efforts by the Trump administration to restrict access to COVID vaccines could be a driving force behind this steep decline.
Confusion and mixed messages from the CDC and Secretary of Health around vaccine recommendations, which contradicted with well-established science, which in turn leads the public wondering, you know, what vaccine should I be getting and where can I get vaccinated?
Currently, COVID vaccines are available for anyone 6 months or older in Washington state and can be found at pharmacies. I'm Mitch Borden reporting.
The Heat Dome event in June of 2021 was not only deadly for people. A new study estimates the damage to trees in Washington and Oregon adds up to scorched areas about the size of Rhode Island. KNKX environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe has more.
Researchers at Oregon State University's College of Forestry wanted to know the extent of the damage from the unprecedented heat in 2021. They knew anecdotally that whole hillsides went from green to red or brown almost overnight. Professor Christopher Still says the best data set they had was satellite imagery, and their analysis of it came up with an estimate of about 1,500 square miles of damaged forest canopy in western Washington and Oregon.
It's about the same size as Rhode Island, so it's quite substantial. And again, this is just a minimum estimate because we don't know British Columbia.
The data from Canada wasn't readily available, but the heat there was worse. Still says three species that jumped out as the most vulnerable to the heat are western hemlock, western red cedar, and Sitka spruce. Among the goals of the research is helping landowners choose more resilient species when replanting. I'm Bellamy Palethorpe reporting.
The official start of the upcoming Washington commercial Dungeness crab season could come as early as December 1st if crab pass preseason tests for meat recovery and domoic acid levels. In the first round of the meat recovery testing 2 weeks ago, the Long Beach area came just shy of season opening criteria. But other testing areas, Astoria, Westport, and Garibaldi, were well above the required percentage. The marine toxin domoic acid has delayed season starts in the past, but officials say it was barely detectable in any of the recent Long Beach and Westport tests. A decision for the season opening date is expected by Friday, November 21st. For commercial crab fishermen, the earlier the start, the better. Over the past 9 seasons, there have only been 2 December starts. The longest delay occurred during the 2020 and 2022 seasons, when first landings were delayed until February. And West Coast states are placing more emphasis on keeping track of crab pots to avoid whale entanglements. According to the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, more than 12,000 crab pots are lost in Puget Sound each year. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Chinook Observer, online at chinookobserver.com. You probably know most sports by name, even if you're not a fan. But have you heard of goalball? OPB's Eric Newman takes us inside a high school competition for blind athletes in Vancouver.
It's nearly silent inside the gymnasium. Players are crouched 3-on-3 in an area the size of a volleyball court. They wear blacked-out goggles and are trying to anticipate a 3-pound ball being hurled past them into a large net. The silence in the gym is only partly anticipation. It's also the rules. If anyone makes noise, the defending team won't be able to hear the ball to stop it. A member of the Washington State School for the Blind, Lions, rolls a ball across the court and scores. This is part of the Junior Cascade Classic at the School for the Blind in Vancouver. Goalball is the only sport designed specifically for people who are blind or low vision. Jen Armbruster is one of the organizers of today's competition.
Ball is about the same size of a guy's basketball, but no air pressure, so it's about a 3-pound medicine ball. At the higher levels, we're throwing between 30 and 35 miles an hour on the women's side and between 35 and 40 miles per hour on the guy's side.
Armbruster lost her vision as a teenager. At the time, basketball had been her ticket to college.
Was playing competitive basketball when I went legally blind, and so got called actually up to say try this sport called goalball. It had ball in it, so I said, what the heck, let's do it.
She's a 7-time Paralympian who has won gold, silver, and bronze medals. She's now retired from the sport and helps organize competitions like this one at the School for the Blind.
Let's go!
At the Junior Cascade Classic, there are teams from Utah, Montana, California, and Florida. The atmosphere is fun. Players have guide dogs in the bleachers, and no one seems too upset if their opponents score. but it's clear the Washington State Lions take the game seriously as they huddle in a circle with their coach between halves.
I think you should keep going with your spin throws. They're beautiful. You're almost going.
Theo Burkhalter is a senior playing for the Lions.
I have never seen really a sport, honestly, out there that is about sound, really. And it's everything's about spatial awareness.
He likes the part about the game that involves being quiet. Sneaky, he says. One of the only ways players know the ball is coming is a small bell inside of it. It jingles towards them at 30 miles an hour. Jess Jinks is another player on the Vancouver women's team.
I'm listening for footsteps, kind of, because sometimes players want to walk, switch around, trying to confuse you or something.
When players throw the ball, bowling style, across the court, their opponents have to dive to the ground to block it. 12th grader Lee Ling Justin says during games, she's thinking about how to cover the gaps between her three-person team.
Well, what I'm thinking about is where the ball is going to be coming from and which direction it will come to. Will it come to the left or to the right?
Goalball was created in 1946, according to the International Paralympic Committee. It was designed as a form of rehabilitation for veterans who lost their sight during World War II. Another Lions team member is Owen Bow. He played competitive football before going blind.
When I went blind, I didn't know of any other sport. I didn't even know blind people had sports. So when I found out about goalball, I was thrilled, and I just fell in love with it.
Owen's mom and dad are at the tournament. They like that here, goalball is treated like sports in public schools. Carla Bow says students have to make practices and keep their grades up to compete.
We like that. We like that they're not treated any differently. It is a different sport in that you have to be quiet when they play, and we're used to like cheering and yelling, and so we're like, oh, like you can't say anything. So, but for Owen, it's been great.
One of the administrators at the school is Corey Grandstaff. He went to the Ohio School for the Blind and played goalball in the early 2000s.
You know, there's a lot of other sports that have been adapted for people who are blind, but this is a sport specifically made for people who are blind. I think that's what makes it unique.
Here at the school, he says, goalball athletes are getting a chance to be active, to be part of a team, and to earn their spot.
You're going to have to work hard to get what you get out of life, right? But life can also throw you some disappointments, right? And so, you know, you learn to lose, right? You learn to win, you learn to lose. You learn all these different skills that any athlete would learn.
Washington State School for the Blind Lions men's and women's teams each got third place at the Junior Cascade Classic. They're competing in the Youth Nationals in Texas in December. I'm Eric Newman reporting.
You're listening to KMUN News. If you have a news tip or story idea, get in touch. Email us at news1@kmun.org. That's news, the numeral 1, at kmun.org.
Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and the KMUN news team. That includes host and producer Skylar Butenshin, intern Sylvia Thorpe, and me, news director Katie Frankowitz. Our news broadcasts air Monday through Thursday, beginning at 7:59 in the morning and 4:59 in the evening. That's all from us today. You're listening to KMUN.